Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Spirit Travels Radio. We are featuring Sober Indian Saturday Night Live. I have George online with me and Wenda. So we're going to start off by saying hello to both of you. And George, I'm going to start with you first. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, well, thank you. Karen, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak on your show and Sober Indians support group for asking me to share my story with other people who are addicted and who are going through things that not a lot of other people do. But with that, I will just say, you know, I'm grateful to be able to share my story with people out there in a bigger world other than where I'm from here on Leech Lake Indian Reservation in Cass Lake, Minnesota.
Well, I want to say thank you for coming on. I'm very excited to talk to you tonight. And please, you know, by all means, go ahead and tell us, you know, how this started for you and where the turning point was. And the floor is all yours.
All right, thank you. Well, my name is, my spiritual name is Mishikwad, and I'll get to that later on. I was, you know, born and raised up in the northern Minnesota logging camps in the 60s. My mom and dad, you know, hard workers, poor folk, Anishinaabe. My mom came from, you know, 16 children, my father about the same. And he was a Korean War vet, frontline medic. And hard worker all his life. Also a man with a troubled past due to the trauma he seen and went through in Korea. I'm not, you know, making any excuses for his behaviors thereafter. You know, it was a choice, I'm guessing, one that, you know, he chose. Let's see. We moved from those logging camps. We moved around to a lot of logging camps back in the day. And I have many beautiful memories of beautiful places up in northern Minnesota. Tar paper shacks, hauling our water, burning firewood. We were all busy. We were always busy. And it was, you never really knew you were poor. Moved to Cass Lake area. Moved to Cass Lake in the late 70s and then moved to the cities. By then, you know, my parents were full-fledged alcoholics, and they worked. You know, one of the things that happened in my lifetime with moving to the cities was it was a great experience going from the woods to all these people and all these buildings, and it was a giant playground. But, you know, still we had alcohol and the behaviors that go with alcoholism involved in our family. Got to meet different races, got to mix with them, and that was a beautiful thing. All the time, you know, my father always made sure that we did work, you know, whatever it was we wanted to do, shovel snow. I had my mom buy me a shoe shine box when I was 9 years old, 10 years old, and I started hitting the streets with a shoe shine box, and I had many great adventures with that, you know, going into bars in the 70s. Got to see a lot of things that I was already accustomed to, the loudness and the fights and all the things that went with that environment, so it didn't bother me too much going around people who were inebriated and watch the behaviors. Let's see, in in the 80s, you know, we moved, or in the mid-70s, we moved back to northern Minnesota. My mother finally got tired of my dad's behaviors because he was not giving up his drink. He would work all week. He'd give my mom half his check, and off he'd go. And one day, you know, she got tired of it. She had gone to treatment and wanted him to change. He wouldn't change, so she just up and left him. Moved us all, moved me and my little sister up north with her. You know, a month or so later, my dad followed, asking my mother to take him back and that he would change his ways. And the love that this man had for his wife came, he showed it by giving up his drinking without having to go to treatment or without having to do all the things that a lot of people do. He just quit drinking and he quit smoking. He turned his life over to God. And he made her dream come true. My mother always wanted to have a farm, you know. And so he got to work and cleared some land that the reservation had set aside or given us. And, you know, he started a pig farm. And it was a beautiful time, you know. My mother also worked as a nurse's aide. And she learned how to drive. You know, and we became what, you know, a normal family, I guess. Even though us kids had already picked up the jug and those behaviors from being exposed to that throughout our lives. And, you know, it was, I'm sure we made our parents' lives very, very hard. In 1979, my brother passed on from drinking. He was an older brother, and he passed on from drinking. He had fallen asleep in a snowbank while he was out, and that morning, that Christmas morning, you know, my mom and dad and I watched a police car pull up, and they delivered the news. And that was devastating. You know, my mother and father's faith never, they didn't lose it. They, you know, my mother broke down and, you know, my father comforted her as well as the rest of the family. And, you know, we made it through that. But in turn, you know, him being her oldest, she always had a special love for him, and that's normal in every family. I don't care what people say, there's just always a connection between one child and a parent. It's just there. It always will be. And she eventually turned that love over on me, and that was different. So after he passed on, you know, they didn't drink. They didn't do the usual drinking that goes on with these types of things that we had grown accustomed to in our life. You know, my father continued doing what he needed to do as far as working jobs. He went back to logging. That was his lifelong job, was logging. He loved it. And he took me out in the woods and started me to logging. And I loved it. It wasn't work. It was just being there with my dad, and I enjoyed it. That's what I did until I joined the Marine Corps and got kicked out of there after about 22 months because of my drinking, my biting, those behaviors that go along with alcoholism. At the time, I didn't think I had a problem. Let's see. In 1987, you know, my mother passed on. She had a split with my father after 38 years of marriage, and that even that did not cause my father to let go of his faith or to drink. He stayed the course, if you will, even though he loved his wife, he loved her enough to let her go. And for me, that was devastating to lose my mother. There was a point in time, you know, I had about 2 or 3 months before that, I had gotten thrown in jail for DWI. And to hear this, to my mother passing while I was locked up, you know, they let me out and I got to go and say goodbye to her and take care of either with my family while this happened. One of the things, and this is important to me, and I need to share it with the people, is I was so devastated that the county sheriff, his name was Jim Dowson at the time, he was concerned enough to get me through mental health and talk with the psychiatrist about what I was going through. And all they did was give me pills and do a lot of talking, and that didn't help. And one day while I was in that jail cell, an elder came in with a suitcase, and that was odd for at the time. And he came in, and there was just something about this elder that he exuded happiness, serenity. He was just, wow. You could just feel his presence, and it was peace that this man had about him. And the charges he was in on were trumped up, and they were later dropped. But he didn't mind that. He knew where he was going in life. He was also a veteran of the Korean-Vietnam War. He had seen a lot of things in his life, and later on I found out that he was a sun dancer, and he had come to terms with his demons. And that was one of the first things in my life that, as I went along, as I look back now, I can see where the dots connect in different situations in my life, and all of them being in a spiritual nature. I had a dream one night of my mother, and in that dream, I was given my name, and I was told what my purpose was by this elder who had came in, the sun dancer. And it was a beautiful thing to have that happen in there with this man. Later on, we became great friends. And he passed on due to cancer. But as I go along here, like I say, a lot of the things that I can look back on and connect as I look back on my path, my trail, my journey, a lot of those things were trauma involved. So, you know, I got my name and I got to understand what my purpose was, and my spiritual name was Mishigwed, which means clear sky or clearing sky. And he told me that because of the dream that he understood, I would one day see things in a clear way. That's why I was named that. If I had time, I would go into more detail, but I don't. But it's beautiful. And as I go along, you know, my father left in 2001. And that was one of the toughest things I've ever gone through. Also, you know, when my father passed, one really feels alone in this world, and that left me with four sisters. Three of them being older, and my littlest, youngest sister. But in 2000, I got sober after my father passed on. I had to go to treatment for 90 days at a place in northeastern Minnesota called Mashkawas, and I had gone there, and I stayed over the 90 days, and I got better. I stayed sober for 3 years, and I met my last wife there, because I've been married 3 times. And, after that, the third marriage she was a traditional woman, more so than I, even though my father was raised Madewi when he had turned to Christianity later on when he quit drinking, and he just quit speaking about the things he knew. And I really wish he would never have done that. I wish he would have continued on with that, because it would have benefited not only me but everybody that was around him. But that was his choice, his belief, and I can't fault him for that. That's just how he was. Coming to where I'm at today, you know, a lot of these things, like I said, we're all, as I look back on them, I can pinpoint different places in my life, the direction to which I am now taking in my life, to jump it further ahead. You know, my last wife was traditional, and she taught me many things and urged me to do many things in a traditional way. For me, that was, it was beautiful. It was frustrating at the time, but, you know, she herself had passed on in 2010. That was a turning point in my life where I chose to find sobriety, because my brother-in-law, my sister Mary's husband of 20 years, well, old man of 20 years, he passed on because he was a banger. And over the years, he had gotten cotton fever, and then it had affected his kidneys, and pretty soon his kidneys were not functioning 20 years later, and he was in real bad pain, and he passed on. My wife passed on shortly after him, 2 weeks after him, and my sister, Mary, had passed on 2 weeks after my wife. So within a month and a half, I had lost my inner core of my people, of the people closest to me. And that was, needless to say, devastating. I had to get drunk. I had to go back to the bottle to keep from going through the withdrawal of my addiction to the opioids. The pain that's associated with opioid withdrawal. I had to get drunk for a month, and then I had to go to treatment. But it was in those times that, you know, because in 2005, I met a man named David Roy, who is my teacher. He's an elder, spiritual man, and Dave... It was instructed, as I was, by a healer from Canada by the name of Ken Corsain, that I was to sit with him and I was to make a pipe and I was to carry this pipe and learn from Dave. And for years I kind of avoided Dave and being around him while I was still using, before Wilma passed on and before my sister and her husband passed on, Marvin passed on. So when I finally got the courage to get up and get motivated, because I knew I didn't want to die. I knew I couldn't. To die would not do justice to what I had gone through. I don't know if that makes sense to. But I knew my life meant more than just that. People, I needed to live for my sisters, my mother, my father. I needed to live for them. And that was my driving force in getting sober, was my wife and my sister and my mother and my father. There's just something that just clicked one day and said, you know what, George, get up off it and go to treatment. And I went to treatment. And I found another elder there who helped me along the way. And I remember I was so ashamed that I had lived this way I had put my pipe up and left it there. And when I went to treatment, I grabbed my pipe down and I took it with me. And I kept it hidden from other clients as I did my intake. And I took it out to this elder named Wally. And I told him, I said, Wally, you know, this is the pipe I was given, and I was told him the story of behind it. And he listened to me. He accepted my tobacco, and he listened to me, and he went and prayed for a while. He came back, and he said, take that pipe and smoke it, and smoke it for the people. Start using that pipe. That pipe was given to you to help you live a good life. He said, later on, you'll use that pipe for other people, but for now, use it for yourself. Come in the lodge. And I started going into that lodge. Started earlier with Dave, but I was still using. Didn't have it in my heart that I needed to change at that moment. One of the things in 2007 was I had taken a gun. Me and Wilma were laying in bed, and we're doing our Oxycontins. I was addicted to them. And I heard a voice tell me to go in the back bedroom and load up the gun and shoot myself. And I heard that voice four times before I got up and went back there. I remember putting that bullet in that gun and pulling the trigger. I lowered it to my chest and pulled the trigger. I remember it, hearing the report of the rifle, and I remember it felt like somebody had slammed me in the hip with a baseball bat. I remember coming to and scooting on my butt out to the hallway where I passed out again. Sweating, nausea. I remember my wife coming and holding me in her arms, and I remember her crying and asking him why I did that. And I passed out again. I remember coming to in the hospital and seeing my wife laying there, or sitting there while I'm laying there, and she's been crying. And she said, I'll never forgive you for what you did. And I said, I'll never do this ever again. And she said, no, that's not what I mean. She said, you called me another woman's name when I thought you were passing. And that hurts.
Oh.
When we have so much pain and so many things happen in our life. I don't know whose name I called her. It could be many that I have shared my life with over the years. But for her to bring that pain to me that I had brought her, it was hard. And when she passed, I went to where she had spoken about dancing because she was a jingle dress dancer. And I went to Bar Erba when I had gone out to a Sundance and helped out there. When I went out there and fasted is when I went to see. We helped with Sundance, me and some of the clients, because I'm now a counselor. And my title is now culture coordinator. I run the sweats and I help guys. I help guys try to understand what they're going through. And I help them with my life, the pain and the suffering I went through. I recently went through Sundance because of a dream a healer interpreted for me. That's what I had to do. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had. Went back. Taking it back to Bar Erba where she danced, I remember I went out there and I offered tobacco and I smoked and I cried, and it was the most beautifulest thing I've ever done. It was like she was right there. And these are things we do to heal ourselves. We need to take our deepest, darkest secrets, our demons, and we need to look at them. We need to have that courage and honesty if we want to be free of our old lives, the memories that keep us from finding our purpose in life and living our purpose in life. Dave once told me, he said, those black spirits are giving you drugs because they do not want you to know what your gift is, what your purpose is. And you need to stop doing what you're doing to get this, to know what your gift is in life. And I've been sober going on 9 years, 8, 9 years. And this has been, I will say it again, one of the most beautifully frustrating things I've ever done in my life. I would never change any of it. The guys that helped me get sober in my life, the guys that encouraged me, Luke Wilson, Matt Hunt, Ed St. John, my counselors, they said, you know what? You should think of becoming a counselor. And I said, I don't think so. You know, who would want to listen to an old drunk, an old addict? And he said, we are. But we would like you to. And they encouraged me to do this, and so I've done this. It's been a beautiful experience with clients who test you, who teach you, other human beings who are addicted. They help you to understand who you are, what your defects are, where you are weak. It's learning your expectations, your limits, setting boundaries, having standards and ethics, something I never had in my using days. I now live a life that is so beautiful. I no longer fear being alone because I'm never alone. Come to terms with that. I have my daily problems. My children still don't listen to me. They're still figuring out life. And all I can do is be there for them and with them. I try never to enable their behaviors. It's called tough love.
Mm-hmm.
I use the same thing with my clients, but I try and be more compassionate about it. I know with empathy, because with empathy, I've been there. I know love is the true thing that brought me healing, that has brought. And it will bring anybody healing if they just reach for that. Because, you know, I know the Creator's love. The Creator has given that love to women. Women have that love because they were chosen to bring life. And so they were given, in my belief, a greater share of this love the Creator has. But being a double, it has a double edge to it, love. It has that beautiful part, and it also has the sad part. And we learn to accept that as we go along. We find that balance in our life, our sober life. We always try, I always try to be aware of my impact, my reaction to another human being, because I don't know what they've gone through in that day or their life. I know how I react to somebody has to be in a kind and gentle way.
Mm-hmm. I want to tell you that I want to extend my deepest respect to you, because I appreciate you sharing your story with us, and I want you to stay on air because I'm going to ask both of you a couple questions near the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But you were meant to do what you're doing now, and I get that passion. I can feel that emotion from you and how you feel about it, and I just want to say thank you. Thank you very much for sharing and doing what you do.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And if you're okay, I want to bring Linda into the conversation now. So please, you know, just hang on, and we'll chat with her, and near the end we'll I'll give you both a chance to say what you want to anybody that may be dealing with addiction right now. Okay?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Linda?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Welcome to the show. I wanted to let you tell everybody a little bit about yourself and then share your story with us.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. Blue Sky Woman. I received my name from my aunt. She gives names, and I got it from a naming ceremony. My English name is Wenda Clear Sky, and the last name came from my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather. His name was Majikwet. It was really a traumatic experience that I went through to quit drinking. It was like the end, the bottom. I could hit no more bottom, and it was I was gonna commit suicide. And it'll be 30 years on January 16th. It was early in the morning. And it's still a little hard to share, you know, because I take myself back there, as I'm sure that everyone, maybe not, but I know that, you know, I can go back to that experience, that bad experience, and then I bring myself out and, you know, out of it. But this, we took him as a brother, my sister and I, my youngest sister, and we were at this native school of writing, and that the day before I was, the weekend before, actually, I was with my boyfriend at that time, and we had been drinking. And before that, I quit drinking for 10 months. Then a month after I was in school, then I started drinking, and that's when I met my boyfriend. And then January came around, you know, that was our thing to do, is to drink, you know, that. And I really didn't like it. And then he wouldn't talk to me the week before that I quit drinking. But that day I was home alone. And my sister and a couple of others that we shared the house with went to school, and I didn't. I stayed back. There was all kinds of liquor on the shelf in the fridge. So that morning I was drinking beer, and the sun was hitting me from the patio doors. And then I was thinking, okay, how am I going to do this? I was thinking about it and sitting there and crying and thinking about all this shit that I put on myself, you know, and some of it wasn't, you know, some of it was mean things that my mother and my sisters said to me, and that was so hurtful. I never had any children, and that's what they'd throw in my face. Still hurts. And the relationships I had were failed relationships. Some of them were very violent. The last man that ever touched me violently was choking me to death, and I could see blackness. You know, that's so I suffered abuse, and I suffered mental abuse, physical abuse throughout my life till that point, to that point, and then that's what it all hit me that, you know, why should I keep on living? What's the point? So there was a big big knife. There's a gun. So I was contemplating which one was I gonna do. So I was sitting there and crying and thinking about all the negative stuff that ever happened to me. Then there was a knock at the door. Excuse me, I gotta drink my water. There was a knock at the door. And this was about 10:30 in the morning. And I was thinking, who is that? So I went to the door and opened the door. It was this young man. His name was Ron Hall. He was a counselor, an AA counselor. He's a good-looking young man. And he took his job seriously. And I knew him. I met him before. And he said, Wanda, are you home alone? I said, yes. He said, oh, I just came to see how you're doing. He said, is everything okay? And I said, yes. And then he said, Wanda, he said, I had a dream about you last night. You were saying, help me, help me. Then I said, then I didn't know what to say. And then he said, so I'm going to ask you again. Are you okay? Then I started crying and I said, no. I said, I was thinking of killing myself. So he came in. We sat at the table. And that's the last time I drank. And I told him everything. And then he talked me out of it, and he talked to me for more than 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. And it didn't even seem like that long, but that's how long it was. And he told me, you know, when your blood is all over, who do you think is going to come and clean it up? He said, it's your family that has to come and clean it up. And he told me, just go and sleep it off. So I did. I slept it off. And the evening came. I woke up about 7. My sister came to see me. My youngest sister, Patty, she came. I just wanted to know if you want to eat. So I got up and I said, you know, come and eat. So I got up and washed my face and went to the kitchen. The house was spick and span. There was no liquor in the house. They took the gun out. They took that big knife out. And they talked to me and they said they weren't going to have any more liquor in the house. And I said, thank you. And but they were talked to about going through. That's why they came and cleaned up the house. What I was going to do. And then my boyfriend at that time phoned me and asked to see me. And I said, well, you know, I said, I'm not going to be drinking anymore. And You know, it's up to you if you want to drink, but I'll let you know right now, I don't want it in my life anymore. I don't want to live that way anymore. You know, I want to have a relationship with a person that's abstaining too, you know, but it's his choice. I'm not going to make anybody quit. They have to do it on their own free will, not because they want to be with me or anything like that. That's what I told him. Then he said he wanted to be with me. So 2 months into the relationship, he was still drinking. So I said, well, then he asked me to move in. I said, that's a big step. I said, I don't think I could do it. You're asking a lot. And you had told me you were going to quit with me. And, you know, I'm not going to force you. And I don't think it's a good idea right now. And then he asked me again. For 2 weeks, he asked me every week. And I said, well, no, I don't think so. He said, well, I really want to be with you and I want to quit drinking. I said, don't quit because of me that you want to be with me. Quit because you want to quit, not because of me. Because you want to be with me, and that's one of my standards now. No. He said, no, I really want to be with you, and I really want to quit. I don't want to have it in my life anymore either. So I moved in with him. The relationship lasted 6 years. And I think it was a year after that he asked me, do you want to go to therapy? And I was so terrified, and I put it off. Because when you have addictions, that's what you do. You put things off. You procrastinate. You know, you think it'll go away. Then he asked me again. He said, let's go as a blended family, me and you and my son. His son was 12 years old. I said, okay. And I was so terrified. I was so terrified because I did not want him to know of my past. You know, I didn't want him to know about father molesting me. And I didn't want him to know that I ran away from home at the age of 14. I didn't want him to know that. I didn't want him to know all this ugly stuff and the abusive relationships I was in. I didn't want anybody to know. You know, that's what I was so terrified to go and talk to this therapist. And so we went. And I didn't know what to expect. We went, and it was him that did the talking because it was him that wanted to go. And he said to the therapist, asked him, why was it your idea to come? And he said, well, we have some problems, he said. And I was thinking, oh, we have problems? You know, I didn't know we had problems. And then I said to, she asked me why I came in. I said, well, it was this idea, so that's why I'm here. And it's my first time going to a therapist. And it was just a little introduction. Second time we came. And my ex always believed that there's a perfect woman. That's his, probably still his belief right now. And I said, she asked him, okay, what kind of problems do you have? Do you want to give me an example? And he said, when we're driving on the street in town, and I'll see a woman and I'll just look at her, you know. And he was Anishinaabe, but Okanagan Anishinaabe, indigenous from interior BC there. And he would always look at white women, especially blonde white women, you know. What's with this guy always looking at these women, you know? And that's what I would think, right? And anyways, he said, yeah, she gets jealous when I look at these women. And then I just looked at him. I said, I do not. And he said, yeah, you do. And then she asked him, well, how do you know that she gets jealous? He said, that's the way she looks. And she said, oh, so you could tell by somebody's expression on what they're thinking? And he said, yeah, I know that's what she's thinking. And she said, well, how many relationships have you been in? Then he said, three. This is your third one? She said, and he said, yeah. So the other two women, did you have the same problem with them too? He said, yeah, I did. He said, the same problem. And then she said to him, well, do you think that it's you that has the problem? And then he said, no. No, it's not me. I don't have the problem. And then she said, well, you do not know what Wenda's thinking, and she does not know what you're thinking. Do you see? She said, and he said, no, I know that's what she's thinking. And she asked me, is that what you think, Wenda? And I said, no, not at all. I'm not jealous, I said. So that was the end of the conversation, and we went home, and I was the passenger and he was the driver, and if a knife could cut through air, that would be the time, because I could just feel he was just fuming, but he didn't want to talk, and it's probably because he didn't know how to express himself, but I could feel his energy. It was dark, and I didn't dare say anything. So we got home, and then he says, that's the last time I'm going to see that therapist. Isn't she divorced? I said, yeah. He said, well, what makes her an expert on anybody's common law marriage or marriages? He said, I didn't say anything. He said, I'm not going next time. So the next time came, I said, are you going to come with me? He said, no, I told you I wasn't going to go. I said, okay, I'm going to go. So my stepson and I went, and she told me, I said, he's not going to come. I said, he's made up his mind. He's not going to come. And she said, okay. Well, did you know that only 2% of men that actually do come for therapy? She said. And I said, no, I didn't know that. And she said, yeah. Well, I could keep on counseling you. And I could teach you tools to be in this relationship. And I'll tell you right now, she said, it could be 6 months down the road, or a year, or 5 years, or 10 years, or whatever, she said, but you will leave this man, she said. After I finish therapy with you, you will decide what you want to do, what you want. And I was thinking in my mind, no, I'm never going to leave this man. I love him too much. You know, I'm committed to him. And she started working with me, and at that time he'd verbally call me a bitch and a whore and whatever, you know, and then I'd tell her, this is what he's saying to me, and I don't like that, you know, I feel like he's disrespecting me, and I have no reason to make him think I'm any of those things that he's saying. So she taught me some tools, and I tried them on him. You know, he didn't even know. And it was just pretty simple things. Like she said, whenever he does that to you, when you are in a room, get up and walk out of that room. Don't defend yourself. Don't engage in the name calling, whatever he's calling you. Don't defend yourself. Just walk out. Then I was thinking, how is that going to help? And she said, you keep doing that. So I kept doing that. Eventually he quit. He quit calling me names. And whenever one of his brothers came over and they were drunk, but he'd talk to them outside and they'd be swearing and I'd be out there. And he said, hey, don't swear in front of my woman. That's what he would say. You know? And I couldn't believe, you know, that it worked. And there were some other things that she helped me with, and mostly with myself, is my growth on myself. She taught me to think about why I did the things I did and why I thought the things I thought. And it came from my childhood, the way I was brought up. There was alcohol, and there was my dad beating my mother, beating her up. Just those two things. So when I was growing up as a teenager, I was out there looking for love. And my low esteem was I wanna drink too, you know, and then I wanna find a boyfriend too. And I found them both. At the age of 15, I was in a relationship, and this man was beating me up and drinking with me. And one day he beat me up so bad. My face was so swollen. I looked like I was an Eskimo, and I could barely see out of my eyes. That's how swollen my whole face was. And I went to the washroom and I looked at myself and I started crying. And I said, why are you putting yourself through this? This man is not even worth it. You know, you deserve better. And after that, after my face went down, he wouldn't let his family see me. He wouldn't let his brothers see me. He wouldn't let his older sisters see me, how my face looked. He kept me in a bedroom until my face went down. And I made up my mind at that time too. I'm never going to let anybody do this to me again. You know, I kept on saying that to myself. And I did. And after that, I was the one that was mean to any boyfriend I had. And the one that was going to, the last one that choked me. You know, I hit him on the head and knocked him out with a hammer. You know, just to get away from him because he said he was going to kill me. And I moved away from the whole province from that. That was before my relationship with this man of 6 years. And 2 years later, after the therapy was over, I did leave this man. And it brought me back home here to where I live in Manitoba. And I found my spirituality. You know, my other younger sister tried to introduce it to me, but it was it was strange to me. So, and I was afraid of it. So I didn't want her smudging in my house. And I feel silly about that now. But I never told her, but I will tell her. And I found my spirituality here. And when I was with this man of 6 years, he didn't believe in God or the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe in anything like that. You know, I was thinking, how can you not believe in something, you know, which steered me towards my spirituality. And throughout my life, I always believed that my dreams meant something. Because after I quit drinking, I had a dream. It was a very beautiful dream, and I wrote about it. There was, in the background, there was green trees. And then there was snow on the ground. Then there was a fence, a wooden fence, the kind they made long time ago when they didn't, just a wooden fence. And then in front of the wooden fence, there was a woman standing there in their regalia, royal blue dresses, and one of them had the deepest, beautiful red dress I ever seen in my life, and they all had braids in their hair. These were all women standing there. They're all in a line, and they were dancing. And then there was one man. He was sitting on a stump, and he had a drum, and he was drumming, and he was singing. And those women were singing and dancing. And then there was a man standing on the side there. So I told that to the medicine man when I came home. He said, yeah, that dream represents for you to Sundance. And I said, oh. And here I had it like 7 years before, 6 years, no, 6 years before that, 5.5, I should say. And I said, yeah, this is what I dreamt 5.5 years ago. He said, well, that's what that means.
Mm-hmm.
So I prepared myself to dance for the next year. And then when I was sun dancing, I remembered when I was a child that my grandmother, my mother's mother, was a sun dancer. That came back to me when I was sun dancing.
Oh,
and my gift after a couple of years, I found out, was to pray for people. That my prayers will be powerful and they will be heard. And I was so, I couldn't believe it. That was my gift. And then one of my aunties, she was my guide on my dad's side, mm-hmm. my dad's sister. And she owned a red dress. So I put two and two together, and this is who I had dreamt of. And here she's helping me. You know, I went for her for guidance on everything, and then she gave me my name. And I felt so, when I got my name, I felt like I was, I wouldn't say reborn, I would say just like my spirit was so happy, and I, they were, like it, I put life into my spirit.
Mm-hmm.
My one experience with sun dancing, I think it was the third year I was sun dancing. I was sun dancing and then. Hello?
Oh, I'm here. I was just going to say I didn't mean to cut you short, and I'm hoping that both of you all could come back on a different show.
Okay.
But I wanted to ask you both real quickly, because it's still recording. The show live has actually stopped at this point, about 2 seconds ago. But if someone came up to either of you and they were dealing with addiction at this point, what would be the one thing that you would say to them?
I don't think there's for me personally, like I've taken counseling, you know, I took a counseling course, and one of the things it says is not to give advice. And throughout my life, I haven't given advice whenever somebody was telling me anything. I would just listen. But the thing I would say, too, is to make them maybe come out of it, is ask them,
mm-hmm.
ask them questions about how they grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, too, is I forgave myself and I love myself. Those two things helps me, you know, because I do love myself. When you forgive yourself and you love yourself, and then you find your value in yourself, when you find that value in yourself, that doesn't mean a dollar sign or anything like that. That means you value yourself, not to put yourself there again where you were when you weren't mm-hmm. happy. When you're letting everything weigh you down and thinking that alcohol and drugs is going to lift it up, it may lift it up, but it's not going to, it's going to crash down harder. That's what I think.
George?
Well, as a counselor for the last 6 years, when I'm approached and somebody asks me, I send them to Rule 25, and I encourage them to seek the help that they need, be it whether it's a Christian-based or Native-based, culturally-based. A lot of these places, a lot of us have conflict between these two worlds, and I tell them you have that right to choose whichever one you are comfortable with, and it is in your best interest and the best interest of your loved ones to seek help, to get that help, because where you're at now and you are now admitting that you may need help, let's go for that. Let's go for that, because this is your life. This is the life of your loved ones, and more power to you, brother or sister. And that's what I tell people is, you know, go for it, because you are at a point in time where you are at a crossroads, a fork in the road, if you will, and you need to make that decision. If it's the wrong one, you can always go back.
True, very true. I want to thank both of you for coming on and sharing your stories tonight. I know you touched a lot of hearts. I know you definitely touched mine. I have someone here that's with me tonight listening, and you definitely touched her. But thank you, and I appreciate both of you very, very much, because I know it was very hard for both of you to share your stories, but I'm grateful that you did.
Thank you, Karen.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Wenda, for sharing.
Oh, get to me, Gwesh. To me, Gwesh, can I? Thank you very much,
Thank
Karen.
Thank you. You're very welcome. And I want to wish you both a really good evening.
Right.
Oh, thank you.
Big wish
thank
to
you,
Patrick
George.
And the sober Indians.
Yes.
Well, we're going to go ahead and end the show now. And you guys have a great evening. And again, thank you for coming on.
Thanks.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Thank you.